I want to welcome to Upcoming Disc Michael Chait. He is the director, producer, and even came up with the story for the film Wolfhound, which is just coming out on Blu-ray and DVD, and I'm sure on all the streaming platforms. So welcome to Upcoming Disc, Michael. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Oh, we're just lucky to have you. I saw the film, in fact, last night. I wanted to be fresh with the movie when I talked to you. And I have to tell you, it's quite striking, particularly all the aerial shots that go on and how well you did them. But I guess the first question I have to ask is, what drew you to this material? There's an obvious passion for the story and for the material here, and I'd like to know why that is for you.
Well, first of all, I'm thrilled that you like the movie. Thank you for watching it. I really appreciate that. And, you know, I grew up the son of a pilot. My dad, Steve Chait, he was a pilot. I think by the time he was 17, he got his pilot's license.
Wow.
He was a flight instructor within a year or two of that. He recently received the FAA Wright Brothers Award, which you only get if you have literally 50 years of, like, incident-free flying.
Wow.
So very few people receive that. That's how serious and passionate about flying and aviation he is. And so I grew up at airports, at air shows. You know, I think my first flight in my dad's Beech Debonair, you know, single-engine, four-seater plane is when I was zero.
Yeah.
My mom, Diane Chait, is an artist. So I grew up both having, you know, a lot of artistic passions, but also really loving aviation.
Right.
And very long story short, fast forward to after film school, I'm doing commercials. I'm directing a commercial for the Yankee Air Museum in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
Okay.
And they have this gorgeous B-17 Flying Fortress bomber called the Yankee Lady.
Mm-hmm.
And the commercial was for that aircraft for their experience flights, where they take customers up for like 45 minutes and you get to actually fly in one of the only 9 flyable B-17s in the world.
Wow.
And so when I stepped onto the airplane, I'm not exaggerating, I got like a rush of emotion, like it hit me like a wall, because I realized, oh my God, you know, back in World War II, where I'm standing right now, the real, like, 18, 19-year-old heroes,
yes,
fighting the Nazis were standing here.
Absolutely.
And I thought two things. One, this commercial better be really good. and two, I think there's a movie here. I think we can do something. Because, you know, I tried to get 2 other movies going in 2010, 2012. Those didn't happen. And I thought this could really be a great first movie. And, you know, being Jewish myself, I also really wanted to have a Jewish-American hero.
Sure.
And that's who James Maslow became, our Jewish-American
right.
fighter pilot. And we found a morsel of history with KG-200, the actual Luftwaffe squadron that did shoot down, capture, and then try to fly Trojan Horse
yeah.
Allied aircraft back into battle. And it never really worked out, but our movie's like, what if it almost did?
Right, your hero stops
it.
Yeah, your hero ends up stopping it. I'm a bit of a history buff myself, and also with aviation. I'm from Reading, Pennsylvania. We used to have a tremendous air show when I was a kid there. It was one of the biggest in the world at one time, and so we got to see some of those kinds of things. But and so looking at these planes, I have to tell you, I've become over the years a little bit of an expert on what might be CG and what's not. Some of the things to look for are lighting differences, you know, some phasing and stuff. I can't find that in your planes. So tell me, these planes are real in the air, aren't they?
Yes, they are, and I'm so thrilled that you were trying to figure out, you know, what's CG and what's real. The mandate that I had going into this was, all the planes have to be real in the air all the time, or we're not doing the movie. And that's not from snobbery. That's
no.
just from, like, me as an audience member and as a filmmaker. Aside from, like, Top Gun, the original,
right.
Battle of Britain from 1969, Pearl Harbor,
sure.
Dunkirk, who we actually were blessed to share the same aerial coordinator, Craig Hosking.
How about that?
Dunkirk for Christopher Nolan.
Right.
You can literally count on one hand the movies that have really committed to all the aircraft being real, and we really wanted to do that. We had the connections in the aviation and the museum world, very thankfully, and so that was all real aside from the destruction shots, those were scale models
right. That
our special effects guys built, and our visual effects supervisor, Ryan Urban, and his team, they augmented the scale models to make
sure.
them look larger, make them have even larger explosions than we were able to do, erasing all the wires and like the stuff where you could tell,
sure.
oh, that's a fake plane. But other than that, you know, there were CG enhancements, CG smoke, sparks, all the
right.
tracer fire was digital, or else I'd be in jail right now. having aircraft firing 50 millimeter, you know,
right.
round.
Obviously.
But aside from that, and some, you know, digital damage, it was 100% real in the air. We shot most of that down in Virginia Beach and over the Atlantic Ocean
yeah.
and over Suffolk, Virginia. And I'm honestly thrilled that you had that reaction, because I just, you know, again, I'm not being a snob, but
no.
one of the worst things for me is seeing a big budget, you know, Hollywood aerial movie or World War II movie or present day, and the planes are fake, and it looks like a video game, and you can just feel
exactly.
it takes so much drama and excitement out of it. And I just thought, we got to do this for real. Like, this is one of the last opportunities we'll have to do it for
yeah.
real, because the planes continue to age, and, you know, unfortunately, every year there's, like, less flyable, you know, amounts of them.
Well, that's the surprising aspect of it, is that, you know, the reason it's not done like you're doing it is because those planes have got to be very difficult to find, especially in the pristine condition they appear to be in, and also in good flight condition where they're safe to go up in the air.
Yes, and I will say, without, you know, pulling the curtain back too far, this movie would not be complete without the army of aircraft mechanics that worked on this movie.
I'll bet.
Every single night, they were tuning them up, they were fixing them, and, you know, because we flew them pretty hard, and the planes are in perfect condition, but,
they
you know, they are from the 1930s and
right.
40s, so, you know, once you flew them in a dogfight, you know, it was the same maneuvers, you just weren't, you know, shooting them up with real bullets.
Right.
They did have to be attended to, you know, some nights very heavily.
Sure.
But, you know, we got all the aircraft from the Yankee Air Museum and the Military Aviation Museum in Virginia Beach. And between Michigan and Virginia, who knew that you had, you know, this small squadron, basically, of military, you know, warbirds from World War II. It's like a best-kept secret.
Yeah.
And the one plane I still can't get over is the ME-109.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's one of only three German-built ones that's flyable today.
Wow.
And that was incredible, just seeing that dogfighting for real in
yeah.
the air. I mean, that was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, for sure.
I'm sure it was. And with all these planes in the air, and that it becomes almost a big character in the show, but let's not forget that you ended up having a pretty good cast overall, but I have to send some real kudos out to James Maslow, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who played the Captain Holden character, because that guy had to carry, I mean, after we had you're you know, treating us to all this air flight stuff, and then we're on the ground for so much part of the film, it's so easy for an audience then to lose some of that excitement and for there to be a letdown. But he really carried it on his shoulders, and in a film that for quite a great amount of it, there's not a lot of dialogue either. So he's had to carry the film, you know, through his emotions, and when he's talking, half the time it's to himself or to an object. So you had to find just the right person to be able to carry the film, especially with the spectacle you're putting in the air, because you got to not have that letdown when it's on the ground or there goes the film.
You're absolutely right, and I think James was an absolute blessing to have. He knocked it out of the park, and then some.
He did.
As did his co-star, you know, counterpart Nazi fighter pilot Trevor Donovan.
Yes.
Who he came into the movie a week and a half after we were filming, because we had to replace an actor that had a medical emergency.
Oh.
And, you know, so both of them, I can never thank them enough for doing it, as well as the whole cast. And I'll get back to James in 2 seconds, but
yeah.
I have to say this about the entire cast of characters.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, and again, I'm not being a snob, I'm not knocking anything. any independent film, especially on a low budget that gets made is a small miracle.
Yeah.
So my hat is off to everyone that does it. But, like, there is unfortunately a trend, well, not a trend, but just an unfortunate occurrence. In a lot of independent films, there's usually that one or two performances that kind of feel like, I don't know, this isn't as good as the other characters. Our entire cast, I know I'm biased, but our entire cast was great. And, like, a lot of the performers are from Michigan, local Michigan actors, some from Chicago, some from Nashville, a few from L.A., but the way that they all stepped up to the plate, and everybody did their own stunts as well, which, as you saw, were very expensive.
Sure.
And so I'm as a director especially, it's like, you know, I need to make everything look pretty, I need to make it exciting, but if the acting sucks, I'm dead. And they really, you know, the whole cast made me look even better. But in terms of James Maslow in particular, he was brought to my attention by my producing partner, Sue Witham's daughter, Ketty Witham, who's been a huge big-time Rush fan, like, her whole life. And she said, you got to look at James. And so when we called him to offer him the part, it was his grandfather's birthday, and we had no idea. And he flew B-17s in World War II.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he was shot down twice. He was awarded tons of medals. He saved his crew each time. And, you know, when James found out what the movie was, he later told me it was like, you know, he got hit by that same emotion that I got hit by when I stepped onto the plane. He said, I have to do this movie. Like, there's no way I'm not doing this. And so he really... and he talks about this on the Blu-ray and DVD, on the commentary, and on the behind the scenes. He did the movie partially as a tribute to not only his grandfather, but that whole generation.
Yeah, and you know what? There's a lot of that passion you can see in the film. In fact, one of the things I was going to ask you is it almost looked like at some point in the film we needed to have a Tarantino-esque countdown or count-off, because it seems like more Nazis got wasted and whacked in this film than in almost any other, especially independent, World War II film I've ever seen.
Well, thank you for noticing, and I am very pleased to tell you we kill 112 Nazis.
Oh, you did count.
I'm sorry. 112 characters in total, 104 Nazis. So 104 Nazi count, that's pretty good. The executive at Lionsgate that acquired the movie and distributed it with us, he gave me my favorite quote about it. 104 Nazis, it's not enough, but it's a good start.
Like I said, after a while, I was like, you know, I was waiting for a little counter to show up, where it'd be like, you know, 10, 11, 12. And of course, you know, when you see the big explosions, you don't know how many of them are actually killed. But we're going to assume that your guys were so right on that, you know, when they blasted them with those rocket projector things at the end and stuff, that they were taking out a bunch of Nazis when they were doing that. But I found it to be, for a low-budget film, and not only that, I mean, between the aerial stuff, the amount of action you've done, the production value, the shooting location's very impressive, the jungles where he crash lands. Where'd you film that at?
Well, you know, that's actually a great story. So this movie was extremely fortunate to have a single investor, and he is a saint. It's Bob Lutz of the auto industry fame. He was one of the top men at Ford, at Chrysler, and at GM especially.
Good man.
At various times. Like, he's responsible for the Dodge Viper, for example. And so he has a farm in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Yeah.
And we were given access to 58 acres of forest that he privately owned. And so there was one section that literally, without having to hardly do anything, it felt like you were in, like, a legit, you know, European forest. Like, that kind of, you know, Sherwood Forest, you know, esque look to it.
Right.
And we could not have been luckier that he had that on his property. And not only were we able to film there, as you saw, we blew stuff up.
Yes, you did.
Machine gun fire. We had fire trails of gasoline and just so much stuff. And the only complaint we ever got, we were told, excuse me, could you please tone down the machine gun fire? The dogs and pigs are starting to get upset. So we did for a few nothing beats real.
No, it
doesn't. And the Nazi base, the big giant hangar,
right.
That was a godsend as well, but it was a little sacrilegious because that's actually back in, at the Yankee Air Museum in Michigan.
Uh-huh.
That is the last remaining structure, the last remaining big giant hangar of the B-24 Ford bomber plant from World War II.
Oh.
That's the
Rosie the Riveter.
Found and took the original photos of Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah, I knew that. Yeah, the Rosie the Riveters thing was going on then. Wow, that so I can understand what you mean. So you turned it into a Nazi base, but what? You did it for good reason, so that you could take out 100. How many was that? 108 Nazis.
Well, 104. I wish it was 108 now, but 104. And that location, you could just feel the history.
Yeah,
and it's like you're outside. And it was 2018 and 2019 when we filmed. Walk inside, you're in the 1940s. And there was a huge amount of production value that World War II reenactment groups brought to the movie. That's like a lot of the set dressing that you see inside the hangar. And we basically tried to build it up like an obstacle course for the action sequences. But it was pretty eerie. Because everything was so authentic, right down to the boots and the wardrobe, the weapons, the flags everywhere. And again, as a Jewish director, there were a couple of days on set where I'm looking around like, this is creeping me out. This is pretty eerie.
I can get that.
It just, we were going to that Indiana Jones, larger than life World War II feel.
Yeah.
And, all those resources coming together really made it possible.
Well, you did a good job of getting a lot of whatever your budget was on the screen with the aerial stuff, with good acting, with finding good locations and such. But let me ask you a question: as seems to happen with any budgeted picture, there has to be something that you either lost or had to compromise on that you wished had been in the film. Did you have anything like that happen to you?
Well, honestly, yes, and it's really two things. One of them you're going to laugh at. Because there is a lot of action, and there's a lot of big fireball explosions that, even for a large budget picture, they're pretty big. My first regret is I wish we had even more explosions, and I wish we killed even more Nazis.
Those four extra Nazis.
Ways. But the second thing, this is, and I think every filmmaker on the planet can relate to this.
Yeah.
Time. I wish we had more time. Because we shot the movie, and this is like a generous amount of time for an independent film of any kind. We filmed for 42 days.
Wow, that is a long shoot for an independent film.
Yeah, but if it was a Hollywood like full blown gigantic budget, like this would have been a 60 or 70 or 80 day shoot. Just to have the ability to kind of slow down and perfect things even more, and I'm a perfectionist visually, and my crew wanted to probably kill me sometimes for that, but like everyone loved the result. But just more flights in the air, more time to tweak things, more time to do more specific, ultra specific action shots.
Right.
It's like I think George Lucas has a very famous quote: films are never completed; they escape.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Yeah.
And, I'd be lying if I said, oh, God, there's so much I wish, we could have changed.
Sure.
We lucked out tremendously.
Like, you did.
I would hardly change a thing. I just wish behind the scenes we had a little more time to do all, the nuances even finer and the action even bigger.
Yeah.
But trust me, I'm still pitching myself every day at what is on the screen.
Right.
And I feel like I shouldn't even say that out loud. I don't want to jinx the universe. Like,
sure.
I am beyond thrilled with what we were able to do.
How much did COVID affect your production?
Well, you know what? Sorry, just drinking a little water there.
No, fine.
COVID came in literally 2 weeks after our last shot.
Oh, cool. Lucky.
And this is pretty lucky on our part. In the very beginning of the movie, and this doesn't give away a spoiler, the chess game that's being played in the radio compartment of the
B-17, right.
The close-up of the pieces hitting the ground.
Yeah.
That of my dad's cameo. He played the doctor that built the Wunderwaffe. He plays the close-up evil Nazi finger of the doctor pushing buttons.
Pushing the button when the... Okay, I see. I know. All right.
So those four shots were the last things that we did.
Wow.
And literally 2 weeks later, COVID hit.
Wow.
And, you know, there's a lot of movies, like friends of mine were making, that had totally shut down and are still not finished today. And then, you know, the tremendous amount of, you know, figuring out and just, like, to get anything shot in the first 6 months or a year
right.
was, you know, hell on earth. You know, trying to, for Hollywood to even figure it out.
Sure.
By the second year, by 2021, production was back up and running mostly, but we were thankfully in post for most all
That's good.
And we were able to do editing, you know, from my computer in Michigan with my editor in California to the visual effects guys in Chicago.
Sure.
And then he's collaborating with people literally in Canada and L.A. and India. You know, the music was recorded in Nashville. The composer was in L.A. So it's like just the rise of literally Zoom and technologies like it really made it possible for us to finish the movie during the pandemic.
That's great.
You know, and I literally did about 2 years of work from my kitchen table. But, you know, it definitely slowed us down. I think that the movie would have been out in 2020 if it hadn't been for the pandemic. And there's nothing good about the pandemic at all.
No.
The only thing that was remotely, you know, helpful is that it did give us a little more time to be able to spend in post.
Sure.
I'm just very thankful that we were done filming when it hit.
Yeah. I'm also a credits watcher, so as I'm watching the credits, I couldn't help but notice you have Jonathan Frakes as part of your thing. Is that the Jonathan Frakes Star Trek Commander Riker fame?
Yes, that is number one himself, and that's a very long story, but I'll give you the short version.
Okay.
So one of the volunteers at the Yankee Air Museum, who's really, you know, his blood, sweat, and tears helped keep the place running. His name is Bob Catalano, and his other job, when he's not volunteering at the museum, is he's a booking agent for conventions, especially Star Trek conventions. And so I got to know Jonathan Frakes because he got to do, he was very gracious enough to do a voiceover for a second commercial we did for the Air Museum in 2015. And I was lucky enough to keep in touch with him. He's one of my favorite directors, mainly for Star Trek First Contact from 1996. I was 12 when I saw that, scared the living crap out of me, and I just remember thinking, like, this is one of the coolest, like, sci-fi action movies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And so he stayed in touch after we initially met, and on the morning of the first day of shooting, I was pretty nervous. You know, this is my first feature film.
Sure.
And he was gracious enough. He got on the phone with me for 45 minutes.
Wow.
And he gave me a combination pep talk and also some really good advice just on how to get the movie done in the amount of days that we had for the budget we had.
Right.
Some camera advice, some you know, tips about, you know, directing the actors, some tips about the whole... just the whole flow of production.
Right.
And it honestly helped us get it done. And then during post, I sent him a few edits here and there, just showing him, like, things I was really proud of.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of gauged, like, okay, yeah, we're going to keep this based on how he responded to it. So his special thanks is a true and well-deserved special thanks in the credits. And I'm also a huge Star Trek fan.
So am I.
It's hard for me not to geek out.
You know,
when I talk to him, but I try to hide that at least a little bit.
I am as well. I'm a huge Trek fan, so it jumped out at me from the credits. And I see we're running out of time, but I just have one more question, if you don't mind. So you did such a good job with this, and you seem to have such a passion for this era and for this subject matter. Do you think that you'll return to it?
You know, I would love to. There's so many stories, both historical fiction, which, you know, a lot of Wolfhound is historical, like what if fiction, but it's based in reality. And there's so many, you know, real stories that have either yet to be told or could be told again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the like a romantic, mythic quality, but also, you know, and this is one of the reasons that we made the movie, you know, again, as a Jewish man, World War II in my family growing up, you know, there's a lot of significance there.
And well, it was devastating.
A lot of families and a lot of people can relate. You know, our family lost a lot of people in the concentration camps.
Yeah.
There's so many families that, you know, of the cast and crew where nobody really talked about it until, oh, we're on a World War II movie. Oh, my grandfather did this, my grandfather did that.
Sure.
And it's like, it's such a pivotal and such a deep, weighty, important period of time.
I agree.
And it means so much, you know, to the world today that we live in. I would gladly return to it, you know, with the right script, with the right story. And, you know, right now we are working up a possible Wolfhound 2. If Lionsgate or the public want a sequel. If they don't, then Wolfhound 1 is fine by itself. But there's definitely other stories that I've thought about. And,
I'm sure.
You know, both in the Pacific Theater, the European Theater. So the super short answer is yes, definitely.
Well, and you know what? I admire your wanting to touch on these subjects because I'm afraid. I taught history for a long time, and one of the fears that I have is when I see, you know, even in politics or anything, people throw around the word concentration camp or Nazis like they do without any idea what that really is. You know, when someone calls a politician a Nazi on TV, it's like you realize you just proved your point, because if he really was, you wouldn't have said that out loud, because tomorrow night you would disappear.
Right.
You know, thugs would come to your home, break through your door, and that's the last anybody would hear from you again. And concentration camps aren't anything like, you know, jail cells. It's a totally different. But you hear prisoners talking about, oh, it's like a con. It's like what a very vast losing of history we have that people throw these terms around so, you know, so easily. And it's there's nothing that we go through in our daily lives that compares to what happened then.
No, and I think as a you know, a former history teacher and a history buff, like you probably agree, the more these stories are told and kept alive, the more that history is kept alive, and the greater of the chance that we won't repeat the same mistake.
Exactly, and that's important. So I love the message, and now I can see where the passion's coming from, and it's a well-placed passion.
Well, thank you, man. I really appreciate that, and, you know, for us to do what we did with this on, you know, the shoestring budget compared to what, you know, it would have cost if it was a full-blown, you know, gigantic tentpole movie, that passion had to come not just from me, but literally every single person on the cast and crew, and I'm not just saying that.
No, I know you're not.
That's why the movie exists. That's why it you were able to watch it last night, and it is what it is. I'm very thankful for it. I'm very proud of it. And, you know, I really appreciate that you could feel that passion coming through the screen, because that is exactly what the goal was.
Well, and if people come and watch this film, I highly recommend that they'll feel that passion as well. I don't think that it'll be hard to do that. And I am very, very grateful to you to actually take your time away from all that you must be doing to talk to me about it and to talk to our listeners out there in upcoming Discland when we post this. And we're very grateful. That's what we can say without it.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it again. Thank you for having me on. And I hope everybody enjoys the Blu-ray and the DVD. There's two in-depth documentaries on how we did it. There's deleted scenes. There's a commentary track where it sounds like we're having way too much fun.
Well, thank you, Mike.
I think after this conversation, you'll probably laugh a little more when you see the behind the scenes and just see how, you know, you're definitely right. The budget was on the screen. Behind the scenes, not so much.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I hope that you get to do something like this again, and I hope down the road we're talking about the next one.
I can't wait to hopefully talk to you about movie number two, whether it's World War II, a Western that we're writing, or something totally different. This has been a great time for me, so thank you for having me on.
It has.
And, yeah, I look forward to talking to you in the future.
All right, you take care.
All right, you too.
Thank you, man.